Your Honors, good morning. May it please the court, thank you for hearing us this morning. I represent Jessica Kaplan. My name is Dean Neuwirth. I'd like to focus this morning on the issues that arise from the statutory definition in the forgery statute of the term, quote unquote, falsely completes, which is 18.5.101.3b, and I'll refer to it in my argument as 3b. The Attorney General in the answer brief more or less concedes that of the various definitions of the acts of forgery, falsely alters, falsely makes, falsely completes, utters, that the only one really that could conceivably apply under these circumstances is the 3B definition. So therefore, if there is an error with respect to that definition, there is an error regarding the basis of conviction and potentially harmful error. So I'd like to discuss that definition in two different contexts. One is whether that definition states a legally adequate theory under what I call in my brief the omitted properties theory, the prosecution's primary factual theory, which was that by omitting her purchase, her prior purchase of some properties from her mortgage applications, my client committed forgery under the definition of 3B. And the other issue is the definition of 3B was not actually given to the jury. The jury was not instructed on it. And the question becomes, without that definition, could this conviction on that basis be a reliable one, or should it be reversed for plain error? So turning first to the issue of legal adequacy, the actual wording, starting with the plain language of the definition, it says, and I'll quote, to falsely complete means, quote, to transform an incomplete written instrument into a complete one by adding or inserting materially false information, or, excuse me, by adding or inserting a material false statement. So the language used in this definition that the legislature has chosen to craft speaks of adding or inserting information, not omitting information. And therefore, our position is that for the theory under 3B to be legally adequate, it has to allege that there was insertion or addition of information. Now, the answer brief alleges that by signing a representation at the end of the application, my client essentially affirmatively represented that she didn't have any omissions. So I view that as kind of backing into the statutory definition. And I think that's contrary to the legislative intent, because if you look at the other definitions of acts to constitute forgery, the falsely alters, falsely makes, and the other definition of falsely completes under 101.3a, they all have an interesting requirement that's not present in 3B, and that requirement is that the person who's modifying or making the document is doing so without the permission of the person who has real authority to make or modify the document. And so the gist of all those definitions of forgery is that the document is not genuine. And then you look at 3B, and that requirement is missing, and you kind of scratch your head. And I tried to figure that out, and I believe that the reason for the very limited nature of the definition of 3B to additions and insertions stems from the fact that in 1918, the Colorado Supreme Court, in a case called DeRose, addressed the question of as follows. There was a railroad foreman responsible for turning in the hours of work of his workers, and he had authority to prepare this document and turn it in, and it was a genuine document, but he padded the hours. There was some worker for whom he wrote down more hours than that worker had actually worked. And the question was, did that constitute forgery? And the Colorado Supreme Court says, no, it does not. That adding false information to an otherwise genuine document by somebody who has authority over the document does not constitute forgery. And that stayed the law up until relatively recently. There's a 1988 case called Avila that deals with that situation. And then in 1994, the legislature adds 3B wholesale to the statute. So the way I read that is that the intention behind 3B is to overrule this old DeRose case and to create a narrow addition to the law of forgery, which otherwise says you need forgery applies when you don't have a genuine document, but it also applies if we have an otherwise genuine document and false information has been added and inserted. But there's no case law in Colorado, and there's nothing in the statutory history that I could find that addressed the question of whether an omission can constitute a forgery, and therefore our position is that viewing the statute under its plain language, an omission does not constitute a forgery, and the case went to the jury under a legally inadequate theory, and in that circumstances, the conviction ought to be reversed. Then with respect to the issue of, let's say there is a legally adequate theory, that the court, the panel, construes the language of 3B broadly enough to include an omission. What happens based on the fact that the jury was simply not instructed on the statutory definition? It was just overlooked. The law says that when the legislature crafts a statutory definition as part of a crime, when that definition is applicable, it must be given. So it should have been given here, and I think both sides agree that error occurred, obvious error occurred, when the instruction was not given. So I think the narrower issue then for the panel to decide is whether the failure to give the statutory definition using the standard of plain error, let me make sure I get the language right, whether it casts doubt on the reliability of the conviction. And I think it does, and here's why. When you have a statutory definition, if the statutory definition is equivalent to the common meaning of a term, and the definition is not given, the law says we can presume that the jurors will use the common definition. And in that circumstance, where the definitions are the same, there's no harm, no foul, because the jury is going to apply a common definition that's the same as the statutory definition. But here we don't have that situation. We have a long and complicated statutory definition that is not the same as the common definition of falsely completes. So if one were to look up the word completes in the regular dictionary, and I looked it up in Webster's Third New International, which is the dictionary that the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court seem to reference the most. That definition says that to complete means to bring to an end, often into a finished or perfected state, to make whole, entire, or perfect. And I think the point of that definition is that most lay jurors, when they hear the term complete, they're going to think something has to be free of omissions. But when you look again at the statutory language of 3B, it only speaks in terms of insertions or additions. And then we have this language at the end of the application that says that the signer represents, and let me read this so I get this right, to the lender that the information provided in this application is true and correct.
Mr. Neuwirth?
Yes, sir.
It seems to me, though, that when a borrower leaves blank a question asking specifically about other obligations, then the borrower has provided information. The borrower is saying there are no other mortgages. That is providing information.
Well, there are always going to be sections in a form like this, the residential loan application, some of which will apply and some of which won't apply. So as a general matter, I don't necessarily think a lender is going to look at an application and assume if there's a blank that means it might apply to that particular borrower.
Well, but the section we're talking about here asks a specific question.
True.
Okay. It's clearly material information. I mean, it sounds like you're speculating the lender might not care if somebody has other obligations, other mortgages out there that it must pay every month. And it seems to me that that is one of the things that a lender is liable to care about the most.
I'm not contesting, Your Honor, that information is something a lender would care about, and there was testimony to that effect in the trial. The question is whether omitting that information constitutes the crime of forgery as opposed to some other crime.
But if I omit that information, I am telling the bank when I sign that statement at the bottom, I don't have any mortgages. That is providing information. I mean, that's how you tell somebody. You can't put something down, is what you're saying. They have to write something specifically. Another way to tell them is to simply leave it blank when it asks you to provide the information. If I'm the banker and I look at that document, the only assumption I can make is that you don't have any outstanding mortgage obligations. That's what you're telling me.
Well, maybe it's because I view this statement as a lawyer, not as a banker, but I read that statement, and if somebody had come to me and said, this is a proposed statement that we want to put at the end of every uniform residential loan application, I would have said, you need to put the word omissions in there. Because by saying provided, some people could think that all they're representing is the truthfulness of the information that they're actually writing down, and that if they omit information, they're not running afoul of this provision. And I think the reason that the conviction is unreliable in this circumstance, following up on your point, is that if the jury had been given the statutory definition of 3B and they saw it talks about insertions and additions, and then they compared it to the language in that representation, I think it becomes the jury's task to apply the law to the facts and to interpret the language in the representation and to decide what they think it meant and whether in this circumstance it was violated. And I think given the definition of 3B, the jurors could have felt it wasn't violated by an omission.
Well, Mr. North, hypothetically speaking, if I were a borrower and I filled out a loan application of this kind, and I actually wrote in something in every other place in the application, but left blank the question asking whether I had any other mortgage obligations, have I not completed the document? Are you saying I haven't completed the document?
Well, I think it's been completed in a colloquial sense. The question is whether it's been completed under the limited definition, limited, stilted, somewhat odd definition of 3B.
So, Mr. Newworth, would it be different then if the defendant here in that blank spot had put the word none? Would that then transform this into a forgery under the statute that requires adding or inserting content?
I think it probably would, Your Honor.
So the difference here is simply the choice to leave it blank versus the choice by making an affirmative false statement.
That's my position. I know it seems technical, but the forgery statute is a highly technical statute. And the point I'm trying to make is that it seems to have been generated for other reasons, a non-genuine document. And this 3B seems to be a very limited addition to it. And really, looking at the situation, it seems to me that the defendant should have been charged with some other crime besides forgery. If the court has no more questions at this time, I'd like to reserve for rebuttal the rest of my time.
First, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I am here representing the people of the state of Colorado. This case arises out of a large mortgage fraud scheme. During the investigation of that scheme, the defendant agreed to be interviewed and made a number of statements that were admitted at trial. She stated that she went to the closings for each of the 17 properties she acquired during a six-month period, and there she read every line of every page of every document before signing her name. She kept extensive records on each of the properties she acquired. Three of the loan applications she signed at closing were obtained from the lenders and admitted at trial. The defendant admitted that she had misrepresented the source of her income on each of these applications, and those applications indisputably did not disclose the seven previous mortgages that the defendant had recently acquired. The loan documents also showed that a company she owned received cash payments at each closing, and the defendant admitted receiving that money. The defendant's primary defense at trial was that she did not have the specific intent to defraud. Rather, she argued that she was taken advantage of by others involved in the larger scheme. The jury's guilty verdict indicates that it rejected that defense. None of the defendant's arguments on appeal were presented to the trial court, nor did they attack the validity of the jury's conclusion that the defendant had the specific intent to defraud. Rather, it's the people's position that they address elements that were established by overwhelming evidence at trial. Turning first to the defendant's argument that the people, or the prosecution, argued a legally inadequate theory, I think this essentially turns on whether omitting liabilities and then on the mortgage application and then citing an affirmation that the application is true and correct is forgery. Admittedly, this is not typically what you would think of when you are thinking of a typical example of what a forgery is, but I think it does fall within the statutory definition, particularly under falsely complete. I also potentially under utters, but focus on falsely completes as I did in the brief. Falsely completes requires that the defendant transform an incomplete written instrument into a complete one by adding or inserting materially false information or adding or inserting a materially false statement. Here, the defendant added an assertion by signing that this application was true and correct. Under the liability...
Can I stop you a minute? I'm sorry to interrupt. Okay. I'm having trouble because this doesn't sound like forgery, mm-hmm. as you just said. So how is this forgery?
I think it's forgery because the statutory definition differs somewhat from the sort of colloquial understanding of what that term is. And I think that as defense counsel pointed out that this section, this falsely completes definition, adds an additional...
I'm not minimizing there's obvious wrongdoing here, mm-hmm. but you think the legislature intended to make this conduct forgery, I mean, prohibit?
I do. I think so. I think it's particularly significant to look at that under the liability section of this application, it says, lists the creditor's name, address, and account number for all outstanding debts, including, and it lists, among other things, real estate loans. It says all debts, not some debts. And the defendant filled that out.
Okay, well, I know what, mm-hmm. I get what she did. That doesn't go back to the more foundational problem that I'm having here.
Well, I think that it's simply just a matter of looking at the statute, the words that it says, and applying them to the situation.
Just do that for us.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So there's a number of elements with the intent to deceive, a particular kind of document that I think aren't at dispute here. I think the focus is really on whether this is falsely completing said document as the statute defines it. Under that, it says to transform an incomplete written instrument into a complete one by adding or inserting materially false information. I think the affirmation that this is true and correct is information, and that it is material to the lender's decision whether they're going to loan money, and that in this case it's false because the application was not true and correct, because under the section liabilities where it said list all of your debts, the defendant did not do so. So I think that by adding her signature under that affirmation, she inserted materially false information or a materially false statement, and then that meets the statutory definition for falsely completes. I think potentially this theory could also fit within the statutory definition for utter, which requires to transfer past or deliver or attempt or cause to be transferred, passed, or delivered to another person any written instrument, article, or thing. That's the definition of utter. And then
was that definition
falsely utter?
Was that theory presented to the jury in instructions?
The utter was defined and given to the jury. So that was that was properly presented to the jury utter as well. When the defendant submitted the false mortgage applications to the lenders, she transferred a materially false document to another person, and with, as the jury found, the specific intent to defraud. Under the statute, I think that is also a forgery. Now, falsely completes and falsely alters were admittedly not defined. They were not given the statutory definitions that they have. However, I think the common understanding of those terms does not differ much from the statutory definitions, and there is no basis in the evidence to conclude that there is a reasonable probability those differences affected the verdict in this case, and thus would require reversal under the plain error standard. As I've already highlighted the definition for falsely completes here, that I think is applicable. The only thing I can see in this definition that might be outside of the general understanding of the term falsely completes is the materiality requirement. And it is on that aspect that one portion of that, the materially false statement, is further defined. And I think because in this case, the evidence on that was overwhelming, and I don't understand that there's a challenge to that this wasn't material information, that there's no reasonable probability that the lack of that portion of the definition would have affected the verdict in this case. Even the complete omission of an element can be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, the element was provided. Its common meaning does not differ much from its defined meaning, and the standard of review is only plain error. So I think there's no reasonable probability that the error in failing to define that term affected the outcome of this proceeding.
Omitting an essential element is not you just kind of blew over that. Walk me through that.
I think there's a lot of case law recognizing that you can, even if an element is entirely omitted, if the evidence...
It's a due process analysis. We look to the instructions as a whole, look to closing arguments, different things like that.
Mm-hmm. And
walk me through that.
I think if the evidence is overwhelming on an issue and the issue is not contested, then the courts have consistently found the omission of an element to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, the arguments of counsel did not address the different meanings.
Said harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I'm saying that that they can be found harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, we're applying a standard that's much less likely to require reversal than that. So I think if those circumstances are met, then certainly in this circumstance also, it would be not plain error. That we'd have to show, you have to show an even higher likelihood.
So if there's overwhelming evidence as determined by who? Somebody other than a jury?
I think that this issue, and I believe that on appeal here, they've has even been conceded that this is material information by both parties. So I don't think that it was a dispute that portion of the definition. And it's here that the element was not omitted. They were told that they had to find this. It's just a matter of what their potential understanding of that term would have been, and would their understanding be different in a way that would that created an actual reasonable probability that the verdict was different here because they did not get that more complete definition of the term. The parties did not seek to apply these terms during closing argument to these facts. However, the theory that was argued, I think it is totally consistent with and indicates that if the jury accepted the prosecution's theory of what they're arguing and found guilty based on that theory, that they found that the defendant falsely completed the applications. And with the specific intent to defraud the lenders. I address the unanimity issue briefly. A jury is not required to unanimously agree on what facts occurred at the case. For example, if there's evidence that either a defendant or a co-defendant shot a victim, the jury does not have to agree on whether the defendant was a complicit or a principal. Or, as in Molina, there was evidence that a defendant solicited multiple people to commit a murder over the course of a year, the jury does not have to agree on who was solicited. The jury is only required to unanimously agree on the ultimate issue, whether the defendant is guilty of the charged offense. In the case relied on by the defendant, Simmons, the defendant was charged with menacing a particular victim. However, the prosecution presented evidence and argued that the jury could convict the defendant for menacing a different victim than was charged. Thus, in that case, it was unclear whether the jury unanimously found the defendant guilty of the charged offense. Here, there is no similar concern. The elemental instruction closely tracked the indictment, and the indictment clearly named both banks. So there's no reasonable probability that the verdict does not reflect that the jury unanimously found the defendant guilty as charged. Now, if the charge involves more than one transaction, then there's the potential that it presents a duplicity problem. However, if that problem is apparent from the face of the charging document, any objection to that issue must be raised prior to trial, or it is waived. There are strong strategic reasons for a defendant to waive a duplicity challenge, as an election prevents jeopardy from attaching to the transactions that were not elected. For example, here an objection might have required the prosecution.
Just Watson, let me interrupt you. Did the jury here have to agree unanimously with regard to which application was false?
I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think that that is required under the case law defining what a unanimous verdict is, what the requirements are for a verdict.
Some jurors could have believed that on day one, that one was false, and some others can agree on the second application was false, and still another could agree that the third application was false, and that would be unanimous.
I believe so.
Is your response premised on the assertion that the three loan applications constitute a single transaction?
I would say that if they are a single transaction, that would support that premise.
Are you contending that they are a single transaction?
And I am contending that they are a single transaction.
All right. Well, we have different dates. They're separated by, a couple of weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Different banks?
Mm-hmm.
Different loan applications. So how can that be a single transaction?
I think Molina looked at the issue of when there is a single transaction. In that case, we had multiple conversations over the course of a year with a number of individuals, and the court found that they were a single transaction by...
But in that case, you have an ultimate goal that is the same in every case.
Mm-hmm.
Kill somebody, a particular person. Okay. Here we don't have that. I mean, we have a loan application to buy a particular piece of property. That's the goal there. And then we have a different loan application 2 weeks later to buy a different piece of property. So we don't have the same ultimate end that might tie together the transactions.
I think that there is a sufficient common scheme that's involved here, this rapid acquisition of multiple loans and kicking money out in each one. I think that Molina, I see my time has expired here, but
chance, right?
I think Molina demonstrated that what they're really concerned about is whether this is unfair to the defendant to be presenting all of these together. They looked at, is jeopardy going to attach to all these? Would these have been severed if they were presented separately? Is evidence admissible in this case now because they have combining these acts that wouldn't otherwise be admitted? And if the defendant had moved to elect here, I think the result would have been that the prosecution would have elected one of the And there were different transactions. The trial court had concluded that the prosecution would have elected one of the applications as count one and then added count twos and three, which would have been the other applications. Then the trial would have proceeded exactly as it did, except that the defendant would be exposed to convictions, three felony convictions and three punishments instead of just the one that they got here. Thank you.
So turning back to the notion of falsely completes, the Attorney General articulated the theory of a forgery under uttering as well, and I don't recall hearing that and seeing that in the Attorney General's answer brief. So if the court is inclined to look at that issue, I would request an opportunity to file a supplemental brief on that point. I will note that in my opening brief, I discussed uttering and articulated a theory that in order to be guilty of forgery for uttering, the document that's uttered has to have been falsely made, falsely completed, or falsely altered. So the bottom line is I don't think that uttering really adds anything. I still think we still end up back at the place of having to decide whether these applications were falsely completed under the 3B definition. And then last, with respect to the failure of the court to instruct the jury on the definition of 3B, the Attorney General stated that he doesn't see any real difference between the common definition of completes and the statutory definition. I respectfully disagree. I think there is a significant difference because, as Judge Jones, you and I discussed a few minutes ago, I think commonly most people think of completing a document as putting everything in it that's asked, that's relevant to a question. But when you look at the definition of 3B, it only talks about inserting or adding. It doesn't say make sure that you don't omit anything. And I think if you give that technical definition to a jury, some jurors would look at it and say, this is all that the law requires here. And when you line that up with the language in the representation that doesn't include omissions, I think some jurors could well have said, this isn't forgery. And that's why I think the conviction is unreliable.
Mr. Newirth, I realize your time is up, but I have a question along those lines. Our review on that issue is for plain error.
Yes, sir.
So isn't it relevant that the theory of defense here was not what you're articulating now or anything really along those lines, but simply that your client lacked the requisite intent to defraud?
It's relevant. I don't think it's a significant factor, Judge Jones, because the omitted properties theory was the primary theory used by the prosecution, and frankly, I don't think my client was very well represented at trial. So I have to look at the theory that the prosecution used and the thrust of the prosecution's evidence, and I think that that's where the plain error lies. Thank you.